You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Have you ever watched an apocalyptic sci-fi movie and wondered, could any of this really happen? I'm Carrie Bechet, and on Hypothetical, we explore what-if questions two ways, through speculative science fiction and through insight from the world's most brilliant scientists. And spoiler alert, your favorite sci-fi movies aren't nearly as far-fetched as you may think. Time travel with me into our possible futures on Hypothetical. New episodes every Tuesday, available on all podcast apps. That's Hypothetical, Hypertheical.
On this weekend, as we remember, honor, and commemorate the lives that were lost and the heroes of the 2001 9/11 terrorist attacks, on this, the 20th anniversary weekend, we wanted to revisit an episode that tells this story. It's Timothy Brown. And his episode is titled, The Only 9/11 Survivor Telling Stories of Heroism in National Intelligence Communities. And Tim is a retired, decorated 20-year FDNY firefighter and a survivor of the 2001 terrorist attack on the World Trade Center. He lost 93 of his friends on September 11th, including his two best friends. The way he tells the story is like no one else. I've never heard a story like his. I have chills just thinking about it. I'm so proud of this episode, and I'm glad that we get to share it with you today.
My name is Timothy Brown. I am the only 9/11 survivor in the room telling the stories of heroism in the top secret national security communities. He turned around, he took his men into the stairwell, and they went up. They knew. He said it. I may never see you again. And he still went in the stairwell. That's the heroism of these firefighters and police officers on the day of 9/11. When they became firefighters and police officers, they took an oath. You say, if called upon, I am willing to give my life for someone I don't know. You just don't know when that day is going to come.
Imagine responding to an emergency call on September 11th, 2001, and finding yourself at the base of the South Tower as it collapsed. Tim Brown, retired, decorated 20-year FDNY firefighter and survivor of the 2001 terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, lost 93 of his friends on September 11th, including his two best friends. So what would you do if you'd survived the most horrific attack ever to take place on U.S. soil? Would you try to forget about it and decide to go on with your life? Or would you spend your time and resources telling your story to make sure that none of us ever forget? Hi, I'm Laura Cathcart-Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. In September 2018, I found myself in an all-too-familiar position. Looking around the room at the other attendees at a famed writer's retreat, I realized that I was the only Black woman in the room. When I wrote about my experience for the Huffington Post, something surprising happened. 24 hours after my piece went live, I had 568 direct messages in my inbox. These were messages from people of all races, ethnicities, creeds, and nationalities who had connected with my piece because they too had felt othered. These are the stories we want to share. This podcast is for anyone who has ever felt alone in a room full of people, which is to say that this podcast is for everyone. You're listening to The Only One in the Room, presented by Lipstick and Vinyl, and executively produced by Christina Barcy. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to like and leave us a review of your thoughts on the show. And if you have an Only One in the Room story you'd like to share, you can DM us on Instagram at The Only One in the Room. Enjoy the show. Before we start the interview, we're talking to Tim Brown. Hi, Tim. How are you?
Hi, Laura. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, really nice to have you. I'm excited to speak with you again. And I didn't get to ask you this when we spoke on the phone. I really want to know, what is the one snack you can never resist? Like, get that away from me.
Pizza.
Pizza?
He went right there.
you were saying it before I even got the next sentence out. You didn't have to think about that.
Tim, I feel you on that, by the way.
Oh, my goodness. Any kind of pizza?
Pretty much. As long as you don't put veggies on it.
Okay. All right. Yeah. You're a pizza purist then, right?
I'm known for eating a lot of pizza, yes.
So can you eat a whole pie by yourself?
In the old days. Not anymore.
Not anymore. Yeah. But isn't it amazing how fast it goes when it's good, though?
Oh, and then how full you feel. And
right.
I should have probably eaten only half of that.
Yes.
I always find myself eating a piece, kind of looking over my shoulder like, oh, there's half left.
Right.
I'm going to do this. I'm going to eat the whole thing.
Well, you know, it's not going to be as good the next day, but it's still good the next day. But it's not as good as it is when it's bubbling hot right out of that pizza oven in the box.
All right, you're making
and I live right in New York. I live right in New York City, so there's plenty of opportunity here.
The best pizza ever.
Oh, yeah.
It's the water, I think. That's what I heard anyway.
Hard water, yeah.
For the crust, because the crust is something that I've never had anywhere else. It's New York, they can claim it.
Even the cheese slices in New York are like over the top.
You know? They're so good. Chicago tries.
Yeah, a lot of pizza. You know, I heard that where I grew up in Connecticut wants their official food to be pizza now.
Uh-oh.
Because of New Haven, where they have a couple of really good pizzerias. So.
Okay. All right. So they want to give New York a run for their money.
They do.
Okay.
They
do. We'll see about that.
Yeah, we'll see.
Thank you for that answer. And if anybody's ever looking for the way to your heart, send this man a pizza first.
There you go.
And then you'll talk.
Straight into the heart.
I am Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room, but I am never the only one in this room because, as usual, my boyfriend, producer, and co-host, Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, is here as well.
Hi, honey.
Hey, honey. So, like I said, today we're talking to Tim Brown. We are so fortunate to be talking to this man, let me tell you.
I know, right?
So Tim is a retired, decorated 20-year FDNY firefighter, a survivor of the 2001 terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, a first responder to the 1993 terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, and a veteran of the New York Urban Search and Rescue Task Force team that responded to the 1995 terrorist attack on the Alfred P. Murray Federal Building in Oklahoma City. Tim lost 93 of his friends on September 11th, including his two best friends. I know, you have to take a minute there. That's unimaginable.
It is.
It's unimaginable loss. And Tim, welcome to the show. And I just got to say our condolences for all those many losses you've experienced over these past years.
Thank you, Lauren Scott. I'm happy to be with you. And although it's extremely difficult to continue to repeatedly tell this story, it's so important that this story be told, the story of the heroes of the day, not just the firefighters and police officers, but civilian heroes who just found themselves in a position where they were able to save people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
I am here speaking because I believe that I'm a faithful man, and I believe that he, with a capital H, wanted me to tell these stories. And so I will speak until I can no longer speak about that day. And so I'm grateful for you guys for having me on.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to tell you, I think I might have told you this when I talked to you, but I took my kids down to Ground Zero. There wasn't much there, but there was a plaque that said, never forget. And I took a picture of them under that and framed it, and it was in their rooms while they were growing up. And now they each have it in their rooms as young adults to carry that with them, that feeling with them. It was somber. They were very young. They were babies when it happened, but they felt the gravity of where they were and that piece of history. And You know, without people like you telling those stories, I don't know that it would have been conveyed that way. You know, if they couldn't have heard it from someone who'd been there, you know, it wouldn't have been the same. So it's because of you and because of people like you telling these stories, they understand and they won't forget. And you've told your story several times. You have TEDx talks, you've been guests on other podcasts and many television shows. And I just, you know, I just wanted to say how grateful we are that you agreed to come on our show. I've never heard anyone tell the story that you have about that day.
I'm grateful, you know, that you're having me on. So
So I know when we spoke, you told me that at the time of the attacks on September 11th, 2001, you weren't working as a firefighter, but in then Mayor Giuliani's Office of Emergency Management, right?
Yes.
Okay. And then also, just before we get into any of that, I just want to acknowledge and thank you for your service, your many, many years of service, your continued service. You were such a patriot. And, you know, just like talking to you, I was so inspired. And I know everybody else is going to be. So I just wanted to thank you for that.
Thank you.
So your offices were at 7 World Trade Center. Was that correct?
Yeah, 7 World Trade, 23rd floor was the Office of Emergency Management, kind of command center, if you will.
Okay.
And that's where my desk was. And the first plane, you know, Flight 11, went right over the roof of our building and slammed into the north face of the North Tower. That was the first impact. That was the first indication that something was wrong. But, you know, in New York City, things like this had happened before. You know, mm-hmm. We had a military bomber fly into the Empire State Building in the 40s. Mm. You know, things happen sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
But we didn't certainly realize that this was the beginning of what it became.
Right. Can you just give me an idea of the proximity of your building to the North and South Tower? Like, were they blocks away? Were they?
No. So 7 World Trade is directly across Vesey Street from 1 World Trade, which was the North Tower, which was the first one to be hit.
Directly across the street. Wow.
Directly across the street.
Yeah. I think you told me you didn't hear that plane hit.
Yeah, I did not.
But so how did you find out what happened?
So I was on the third floor mezzanine where the cafeteria was in 7 World Trade Center. And every morning I went in a little before 8 and I would buy all the newspapers because we didn't have, you know, smartphones and things like that back then. So I would buy all the local newspapers and go through them to make sure I was up on the happenings of the city.
Right.
And I would have my Cheerios. I would sit there and thumb through the papers pretty quickly and eat. And the power went out in the building, which is very unusual for a modern high-rise building in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
So that got my attention, but I didn't know why. And the power came back on in 5 seconds. So I knew that our emergency generators had kicked in to supply the building. And when this happened, the people who were sitting at the window facing the World Trade Center complex all at once jumped up and started running toward the exit screaming.
Oh.
And they had to run by me to get to the exit. And so I wound up grabbing one young lady by the shoulders. And I actually had to like shake her back to reality and say what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And she said a plane hit the tower, and that's the first I knew of it.
Wow.
Was from her. Some things happened, and, you know, I went up to the 23rd floor. I'm going to try and shorten this a bit. But I wound up back down on Vesey Street because my job was to go to the command center, the fire command station in the North Tower, and to support the incident commander, who was the fire chief in this case.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to go to my car. So I had a city issued like undercover police car, and I opened the trunk and I took off my tie and my dress shirt and I put on my heavy leather boots and my mayor's office jacket and this stupid green helmet they made us wear.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trained as firefighters. Before you go in a building, you look at three sides of it, so you understand what's happening to the building. And I did that. And then I went into the North Tower at the plaza level, which was one level above the street level. And there was an escalator. I had to go back down inside the building. I had to go back down to the street level lobby. And there was an escalator there. And there were hundreds of office workers evacuating down that escalator, kind of like a funnel. And something I noticed, Laura, in that moment, which has stayed with me ever since, is that you, instead of what you would expect to happen when people are trying to get out of a building that's just been hit by kind of by a bomb, they weren't pushing and screaming and kicking and trampling each other. It was the opposite. That for every person who was injured or obese or disabled or pregnant, anyone who needed help, there were four or five office workers helping that person out.
Wow.
So it was the opposite of what you would think. And just in that moment in my head, I said, no matter what happens today, we're going to be okay, because that's the true spirit of humanity for the most part.
Yeah.
You know, we help each other. And I got on the escalator and I went down and I looked out over this big open expanse of the lobby, and there were hundreds of firefighters awaiting their orders to go up into the tower. And, you know, the firefighters wear the turnout gear with the yellow reflective stripes on it. And there were hundreds of them. And I chuckled inside my head because I said, now I understand why the cops call us bumblebees. Because when we get together by the 50s or 100s, we look like a hive with all those yellow stripes.
If it's dim lighting, that's like what you can see, right?
Or the yellow stripes. So I got to the bottom of the escalator, and right in front of me was a bumblebee. And I looked at his face, and it was my very good friend, firefighter Chris Blackwell, who I had worked with for 7 years in the Special Operations Rescue Company in the Bronx. And we were the Bronx guys. So we were the, you know, our gear was ratty and torn and dirty and smoky. And you know, we weren't the Manhattan guys. We, you know, we didn't always follow the rules, but if you wanted to be rescued from a fire, you wanted us to come.
Right. And you guys were getting down and dirty.
We were known as being fairly dirty.
Okay. And
Chris and I had this greeting. I loved him with all my heart. And we always had this greeting, no matter what it was, when we saw each other at an incident, we would come face to face, come to attention. And even if there's snot running down our faces, he always had the unlit stub of a cigar in his mouth. So he would take that out. We would lean into each other, kiss on the lips, and stand back up, and he would put the cigar back in his mouth. And we would do that no matter how dirty we were. And the truth was that I loved this man with all my heart, and he loved each other. And we counted on each other. And we also thought it was very funny because all the firemen would get freaked out when we did it. So we just thought it was an awesome thing to do. And I actually did that with Chris in the lobby of the North Tower. And he said to me, Timmy, this is really bad. And I said, I know, Chris. I love you. And he said, I love you too. I said, be careful. And what did Chris do? He turned around and he went in the stairwell and he went up the stairs to save people's lives. And he told me, right? He said it to me, this is really bad. You know, he knew it. He didn't turn around and go out the door and go home. He went up the stairs to help people he didn't know.
We're going to take just a quick break to tell you about a cool new product that Scott and I discovered. And we'll get back to our guest's amazing Only One story in just a minute.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase.
Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Do you like science fiction? I'm Carrie Bechet, and if you loved movies like Arrival or Interstellar, then you're going to want to check out my podcast, Hypothetical. On Hypothetical, we tell speculative sci-fi stories interwoven with real science. New episodes every Tuesday, available wherever you get podcasts.
You said that you stopped when you put on your jacket and you looked at the three sides of the building before you went in.
Yeah.
Did you see anything at that point that prepared you for what was about to happen? Or did you think, we're going to go in there and rescue everybody?
I've never been in a situation where we didn't rescue everybody, or at least get there. You know, we couldn't always save them, but at least we got there.
Right.
I was certainly concerned that this would be a difficult one to even get there, to walk up 80 floors with 100 pounds of equipment on your back, which they estimate takes over an hour.
Right. And that's what Chris was heading up to do.
He was headed up those stairs. And so Chris turns and goes up the stairs. It's the last time I see my friend, Chris. Someone yelled my name across the lobby, and you can hear it on the French filmmaker's video. He had a camera going in the lobby. And you can hear my best friend, Captain Terry Hatton, yell my name. He yelled, Timmy! Mm-hmm. And I went running over to him among the sea of bumblebees. And he was 6'4", so he was hard to miss. And he was the captain of Rescue One, the elite special forces of the Manhattan Fire Department. And he was the boss because he was that good. He was that smart. He was that experienced. He was that decorated. Before he stepped foot into the North Tower on this day, he had a larger-than-life reputation. And he had the Halligan, a big pry bar in his hand, and he wrapped his arms around me. And I kind of got smothered in him because he's such a big guy. And he kissed me on my right cheek, and he said in my right ear, I love you, brother. I may never see you again. And I blew him off because we had done all these things together, Oklahoma City and the two attacks at the World Trade Center and building collapses and horrific fires that we had fought together and, right. and come out fairly unscathed. And so I blew him off. I was like, yeah, you know, be careful. I love you. So he kissed me on the cheek and he said in my ear, I love you, brother. I may never see you again. He took his men. He turned around, he took his men into the stairwell, and they went up. Same thing. They knew. He said it to me, Laura. He said it. I may never see you again. And he still went in the stairwell. That's the heroism of these firefighters and police officers on the day of 9/11.
Right.
They took an oath. When they became firefighters and police officers, they took an oath in what we call the probie school, the rookie school, whatever you... You say, if called upon, I am willing to give my life for someone I don't know. You just don't know when that day is going to come. So Chris and Terry and my other best friend, Patty Brown, and 343 New York City firefighters, 37 Port Authority police officers, 23 NYPD police officers, all fulfilled their oath on September 11, 2001. And I only tell a few stories of the heroism because I only witnessed, you know, a few compared to the number
that
occurred. And so, but these are just examples of what these men and women did on that day.
I wanted to ask you this. I think I know the answer, but at this point, you know, this is a passenger plane that has hit the North Tower and embedded itself in it. Are you thinking this is an accident when it's just the North Tower still, or are you suspecting that this is a terrorist attack?
Me personally, I did not suspect. The thought was in my mind. I just didn't think that that was true. However, the first fire chief, Chief Joe Pfeiffer, who actually witnessed the impact, now in a video recording we have, he actually says in his fire chief car en route to the tower, he actually says it looks like the plane aimed for the building. This was a terrorist attack. But that word didn't get out to everyone really quickly, you know?
Sure, and it's mayhem anyway, right? It's just...
Such mayhem.
Yeah.
Such mayhem. So Terry and his men go up the stairs. They make Rescue One, FDNY Rescue One, makes it to the 83rd floor where they are saving people's lives. And they're right at the very bottom edge of the carnage. The second plane hits. Again, I didn't hear it, but a fireman came running into the lobby where we were yelling, another plane hit the South Tower. And of course, as the whole world knew, we knew, everybody knows it's a terrorist attack. And the leadership huddled up. We decided to split our forces. They sent myself and Assistant Chief Donald Burns from the fire department over to the South Tower to open that command post to manage the second worst disaster in the history of the city of New York that's occurring at the same time the first worst disaster is occurring. And trying to figure out how to deal with it. So Chief Burns, my very good friend Chief Burns, 41 years in the New York City Fire Department. If you looked in a dictionary at his mug, it would say Irish fire chief with the rosy red cheeks and the lines of experience in his face. Because he had seen everything. And he was from the outer boroughs, so he had a bit of a thicker accent. And he talked really fast out of only the right side of his mouth. And the left side stayed closed.
Right.
And he said to me, Timmy, there's not much you and I can do. Oh, I've ordered a fifth alarm. Do your best and be careful. And he said, you know, we're at war, right? And I said, I know, Chief. A woman came over to us yelling that there were people trapped in the elevator. The chief gave me the nod, go with her. So he went to the command post. I went with her. We came to the elevator's lobby in the South Tower now, and she took me right to an elevator where the doors were open so you could see into the shaft, but the elevator car itself was stuck, and you could only, at the top of the opening, you could just see the people's feet that were trapped in the car, and they were screaming, and I didn't know this at that time, but that elevator car had free fallen 70 floors because the plane plane that hit the South Tower snapped its cable.
Right.
Imagine in 70-story free fall, just waiting for the crash. And then the emergency brakes come on, and the elevator worked the way it was supposed to. And the elevator car stopped before it hit the concrete pit and killed everyone. So, but now it's stuck there, and those brakes are holding onto it pretty strong, so you can't move it. And they were screaming in addition to that because the elevator pit below them was full of jet fuel that was on fire.
Oh, my goodness.
So they were getting burned. They were above it. I'm trying not to be too graphic, but they were getting burned. I did my best being an alleged fireman who was really a mayor's office guy because I didn't have any tools or my gear or anything. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, right next to me, another bumblebee just shows up, almost like an angel. And he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, Timmy, I got it. And his name was Firefighter Mike Lynch from Ladder 4. And he was actually a real fireman, Laura, because he had all his gear and tools and equipment and a whole fire truck of equipment, and he was the one those people needed to see. Later on, I told his widow in the living room in Long Island with her two young boys that her husband had died an American hero saving people's lives, and I was the last one to see him. And he stayed there getting those people out of that elevator until the whole building came down and killed him.
Mm.
We know he saved three women because they identify the guy with the red four on his helmet.
Wow.
So we know Mike Lynch, was American hero. They later found his body exactly where I said it would be, with the elevator and the people who did not get out of the elevator. Over my radio, urgent, confirmed by the FBI, third plane incoming, it's ours. Prepare for it. Get in the stairwells, prepare for impact.
Oh, no.
Urgent. Mike, I got to go. I went over to the command post. I found a landline that worked, and I dialed 0 for operator. And she picked up right away, and I said, I'm with the Mayor Giuliani in the towers, and I need to talk to the White House immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And she tried to get through, and she couldn't. And I said, then the Pentagon. And she said, the Pentagon's under attack. And we didn't know that until then. Our situational awareness was about 0. I finally talked to New York State Emergency Management, and they assured me that the fighter jets were already scrambled and coming to us as fast as they could to protect us overhead so that we could do our job trying to save people's lives in the towers.
One plane had hit the North Tower right around 9 o'clock, right?
A little before.
A little before 9. And then the second plane hit the South Tower.
A little bit after 9.
Okay. So like maybe 20 minutes apart?
It was about that, yeah. I always forget these numbers, but it's about under 30. I think it was under 30. There's a whole story about that.
Right. I want to hear that. I want you to tell that part too. But then there's a third plane that's reported to be headed your way as well. And so you are still and everybody else is still there trying to get out as many people as you can, because you know now that these buildings are going to come down, or you just think that people are, it's going to burn down?
We've never had a high-rise collapse from a fire ever in New York. I think anywhere in America, we've never had a high-rise building collapse from a fire.
So you're just thinking fire. We just need to get these people out because of the smoke and the fire itself.
Yeah. Initially, the chief of department, Pete Gensy, said we can get, or maybe it was Ray Downey from Special Operations, said we can get everybody out from below the fire. We can save everybody below the fire. But we're going to have a hard time getting anyone at or above that because we can't get water up there. We can't get enough water up there to put these fires out. So that was our goal. Our goal was to get everyone out that was below the fire.
And then what were you going to say about the timing of the first plane and the second plane?
Well, there were indications, you know, I never got an answer on this, but there were indications that the terrorists in their pre-planning for this were calling in false alarms in the month or two before 9/11 in order to time the response of the police and fire department so that the second plane would kill as many cops and firemen as possible.
Because they would have all responded to the first one.
Exactly. It's a common terrorist method, secondary attack, to kill the cops and firemen. So, you know, we think, I'm saying this in my personal capacity, that they did that and they timed it to kill as many firemen and cops as they could. The lobby was filling up. I'll try and go quick through this. The lobby was filling up with people that were badly injured. So Chief Burns said to me, "Timmy, go get the paramedics." And I ran out. There was a fireman dead in the street who was crushed by a woman who had jumped out of the building. He was the first fireman to be, I'll say, murdered on September 11th. And I found the paramedics and we were about 20 feet from the door of the South Tower going back in, myself and three paramedics, when the building collapsed. And it was so loud and so obvious what it was that nobody questioned it. And we're trained you can never outrun a collapse because it happens too fast. So I yelled at the paramedics to follow me, and we went into the adjoining 3 World Trade Center, who was the Marriott Hotel, to try and get some protection over our heads. The South Tower collapsed onto the Marriott Hotel, and the Marriott Hotel collapsed around us.
Wow. So I just want to go back a second. So the building is coming down, and you're running out telling people to follow you?
I yelled to the three paramedics I was with.
Yeah, yeah.
To follow me. This is just automatic. You know, I have experience, and I have a lot of training.
Wow.
And I knew that our only chance of survival in this second was to get protection over our heads.
So you ran out of there, but instead of like continuing to run like down the street, you ran into another.
We were outside. We were outside.
Oh, you were
on
outside.
The sidewalk.
I see. So you ran inside for protection to this
the
Marriott.
Into the Marriott Hotel, yeah, for protection.
Okay.
The part of the hotel we ran into was the restaurant. It was called the Tall Ships Restaurant, and it was as clear as day in there. And in a split second, it was pitch black because the building was collapsing around us. The wind picked up tremendously. The noise I compared to being on the tarmac at JFK, sitting on the tarmac surrounded by 747s full blast. And I don't know how else to describe how loud it was. The only way I was going to live, the only slight chance I had, was to find a vertical column. Because in our experience, when we find people who survive a building collapse, we find them near vertical columns because that's the strongest part of a building. So I knew I had to get to a vertical column. I crawled as fast as I could, blind. You couldn't hear, you couldn't see. And I found somehow, and I go back to my faith, I found a big vertical column and I wrapped my arms around it and I held on for my life.
Wow.
And the wind, as the building was collapsing, the air was being pushed out of the building. My legs were up in the air. It was trying to blow me out into the street where I knew I would be dead for sure. And I don't know where I found the strength to hold on to this column, because in a scientific study later on that's documented in a book, a volcanologist, they wanted to find out why we survived about 35 people in this space. And he scientifically proved that the air, the wind in this space was 185 miles an hour.
Wow.
So that was the air that was trying, the wind that was trying to blow me out into the street. I have no idea how I was able to hold on to this column. Mm. And, you know, I just waited to be crushed. And I wound up, there's more to the story. I wind up getting out, but I want to talk about other things too. The paramedics I was with all survived.
Wow. Those three.
Yep. The three of them survived. I am in touch with, one of them, my good friend, Charlie Wells, to this day, we stay in touch.
Boy, is that a bonding experience, right? Have survived that. So I want to know what happens after the wind dies down and you emerge from the Marriott.
We were kind of stuck there because the building was now collapsed. And we kind of bounced around inside. Mm. There were some firemen and civilians trapped behind a roll-down gate. A metal roll-down gate that separated the lobby of the hotel from the tall ship's restaurant. So when they were closed, they put the gate down. And this gate had come down in the collapse, and they were trapped on the other side. So I was able to get that gate up a little bit, and then all these fingers came from the other side, and we lifted the gate up. And between us, I'm guessing around 35 people were able to make it across the rubble because a fireman came in from the outside with a real bright flashlight, and he was yelling to us to follow him, and we made it out. I wind up running up West Street, and I went by two chief friends of mine, and they yelled to me to be careful.
Where were you running to?
I was running northbound because my boss, Calvin, was trapped in the collapse, and he was yelling in his radio. Mm. So I was trying to go find him and get him out. So I was running up West Street. I see the two chiefs, Chief Downey and Chief Feehan, and both my very good friends. And they yell at me, Timmy, be careful. And I live and they both die. Mm. And I found my boss. He was already dug out of the rubble by some firemen and cops. And the mayor was yelling for us to get with him. And so myself and my bigger boss, John Odomat, who was a police chief in OEM, we both ran north. And the people behind me started screaming, and I turned around and I saw the antenna of the North Tower kind of bend to the side and then disappear straight down as the North Tower collapsed. Mm. And of course, I knew Terry and Chris, and a lot of my friends were in there, Patrick, and just kept running. We got overwhelmed by the dust cloud and some of the rubble, but nothing that ever really substantially injured me.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. You didn't have any injuries, huh?
I had no major physical injuries.
Right, right. You might have still been in like shock and been able to run and that kind of stuff, but that debris field, that debris cloud was, I mean, I've heard so many people talk about it was so thick and people couldn't breathe.
You would actually, suffocate in the street, outside in the street, you would suffocate, yeah.
Wow. You talked about going to visit Michael's widow. Can you talk about that at all, or would you rather not?
No, I can. It's actually turning into a beautiful story. So Mike Lynch's widow, Denise, when I went to her house and I told her what a hero and angel her husband was on the day of September 11th, I gave her my business card and I said, you know, I knew her husband. I didn't know her very well. And I gave her my business card and I said, one day when your sons are older, save this card and give it to them and tell them if they want to talk about their dad, I will talk with them one day, God willing. Mm-hmm. And about a year ago, I got a phone call from 22-year-old Michael Francis Lynch Jr., who said, I want to know about my dad.
Wow.
And so we were finally able to meet up, and we, as they say, got along like peas and carrots. And he became, I would never say I could ever replace his father, so I would say I'd be more like an uncle. But we just clicked and we got along very well. And I have been mentoring him. He wants to go in the military and special forces. And I happen to know a lot of those people. And so we went on an American tour. I took him around to meet a whole lot of really awesome, amazing, talented people who have done great things to protect America. Wow. And so now Michael is on Wednesday, I think, he's going to drive down to the DC area, and he's going to get some pretty intense training so that he's, when he's ready to take the ultimate test and become one of the most talented in the United States military, he will be prepared for it.
Incredible.
Yeah.
That is absolutely incredible.
I'm like bursting with pride.
Yeah, I can hear it.
Hearing his dad shout down at him from heaven how proud he is of him.
Well, how beautiful that you were, because you were the last one to speak to his dad, right?
Yeah, yes.
And that you show up without really having had interaction with his widow at that point. But
no, not for almost 20 years.
Yeah, and then this young man on his own has decided that he wants to get to know his dad through you, and that you're able to extend yourself, and you're so grateful too, right?
I'm so grateful. And
yeah.
If this is the reason that God kept me around, then I fulfilled it, and I'm honored, you know, because, man, this is fulfilling. And, you know, we give young people a bad rap, you know, we say kids these days, and, you know, this and that, because, but you look at people like young Mike, and I don't think so. I'm so proud of young people.
Yeah.
And I am very comfortable leaving this country in the capable hands of a young man like Michael Lynch.
Mm-hmm. I am too, from what you tell me. And then, so just speaking about why you're still here, because we talked about that a little bit too. And I think you and I both agree that you are here to tell these stories that other people can't. You're here to speak for people, the heroes that you witnessed, not just the ones who perished in that terrorist attack. There are people that survived and died terrible deaths from 9/11 illness. Is that right?
Yeah.
So you were I hear fire trucks behind you.
Yeah, it's New York. I'm sorry.
No, it's great sound effects.
And we don't have to add those later.
We don't have to add those later. Exactly. Was it Patty Brown that you were talking about who died from 9/11 illness?
So Patty Brown, the highest decorated New York City fireman, murdered on September 11th. He was also one of my two best friends.
Mm.
In the weeks after 9/11, his brother Michael had driven across the country from Las Vegas to New York.
Mm-hmm.
He was a ER physician in Las Vegas. And he came to New York to dig through the rubble for his brother.
Mm-hmm. And you couldn't fly then, obviously. Everything was grounded.
So he drove. Yeah.
Okay.
So he spends a few weeks on the pile, and then he has to go back to work in Vegas. So I got very close with Michael very quickly, you know, and I became kind of like a brother with him. And over the last nearly, I guess I would say 15 years. And so I was going back and forth to Vegas to visit with him because we were just great. We became great friends. And then Mike got sick. He got sick from 9/11 illness, from breathing the dust. And just 2 months ago, Mike passed away.
I'm so sorry.
Mike's death is the hardest one since 9/11 for me personally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, there's only one family member left, their sister, Carolyn, who had to say goodbye to her only two brothers. Her mom is gone. Her dad is gone.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying my best to support her and the extended family of Michael Brown. And, you know, but Michael was very personal for me. But this is happening several times a week now between police officers and firefighters and construction workers and the urban search and rescue teams that came from all over America to help us.
Mm-hmm. I had something I wanted to read. It's John Stewart's speech to the House Judiciary Committee. Not the whole speech, but
sure.
He says, behind me, a filled room of 9/11 illness first responders. So he's painting the picture, right? And behind me, there's this whole room filled with 9/11 illness first responders. In front of me, a nearly empty Congress. And then he says, sick and dying, they brought themselves down here to speak to no one. It's shameful. It's an embarrassment to the country, and it is a stain on this institution. And you should be ashamed of yourselves for those that aren't here. But you won't be, because accountability doesn't appear to be something that occurs in this chamber. We don't want to be here. Lou, Detective Luis Alvarez, doesn't want to be here. None of these people want to be here, but they are. They're not here for themselves. They're here to continue fighting for what's right. Lou's going to go back for his 69th chemo. The great Ray Pfeiffer would come down here, his body riddled with cancer and pain, where he could walk, and the disrespect shown to him and the other lobbyists on this bill is utterly unacceptable. And then he goes on from there. But I was so struck and impacted by his speech. And I just wanted to hear, A, what you thought about it, and then what you'd like us to know about 9/11 illness.
Without John Stewart, this never would have happened, because nobody would listen to a bunch of firemen and cops and construction workers from New York. Mm. But because John Stewart commands attention in the media, and he was so passionate and articulate in the way he spoke about it, because he really believed in it, and he was very angry about the way that they were being treated.
Yeah.
I know these guys. Ray Pfeiffer was a really good friend of mine, and it was not easy for them to go down there and wheel themselves in their wheelchairs around Congress people who are trying to run away and hide behind their doors. Mm-hmm. What's happening to us, we can blame Congress, and they certainly deserve to be shamed. Not all of them, but we still have to go back to who did this, because we don't talk about it.
Okay.
Who did it and why they did it. And that's important, because if we don't tell the truth, the whole truth, then we're doomed to repeat history, right? Mm-hmm. Radical Islamic terrorists were able to plan this a little bit under our noses.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so important that when I go to these places in the intelligence community to tell the story, I kind of shake them back to reality also. And I say, don't forget how this happened and who did it and why they did it. And I never say 3,000 Americans, because it wasn't. It was people from dozens of countries,
right,
who were innocent. They were just all innocent human beings. You know, it's I don't know. It's today we continue to lose at least a few a week now from 9/11 illness. We're doing our best to support their families. The Stephen Siller Tunnel to Towers Foundation has been supporting a lot of these families, the Ray Pfeiffer Foundation, and we will be doing some really big things coming up this year because of the 20th anniversary. The Siller Foundation will make some big announcements, and those are the charities that I support. They're charities managed by us, by the Siller family. Stephen Siller was a fireman murdered on September 11th. This is his family that runs it.
That's the Tunnel to Towers?
Yeah, Tunnel to Towers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I volunteer. Just this morning on Fox News, Frank Siller announced that they were paying off, because I'm a part of it, are paying off the mortgages of the two FBI agents who were murdered 2 days ago.
In Florida,
yeah.
Yes, yeah. Oh, it's so tragic.
I was part of helping to make that happen.
Wow.
These are the good things that come out of it, you know, and if we can help these families at all, of the first responders and the military and the Gold Star families, these are the people who keep us safe and the people who have volunteered to take that oath and say, I will give my life for freedom and I will give my life for people I don't know, for Americans I don't know. I mean, who does that, Laura? Who does that?
I don't know. Yeah. I do not know.
Amazing.
Well, you did. You do. That's why we wanted to talk to you. We needed someone who has been that to tell this story. And the other thing I told you was that after 9/11, after the attack, I started taking my kids to our local fire station a few times a year and just bringing food and saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. Yeah. Can't thank you enough. And it's something we have continued to do since then. Every year, several times a year, we go by, we bring gift cards, we bring food, we bring toilet paper, like anything that they have to go to the grocery store to buy. And it's a little thing. It's not anywhere near on the scale of what you're doing, but it's just to keep that continuous stream of appreciation pouring into our first responders. We need them to know how much we appreciate you guys running toward danger rather than away from it. And I don't know who does that, but you guys do.
There are just over 1 million firefighters in America. 800,000 of them are volunteer firefighters. Mm. So not only do they volunteer, but they volunteer to give their life for their community if, mm-hmm. if called upon, you know, right. like wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Incredible. I also wanted to mention just before we close that you've inspired a family member of yours, your niece, is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
Taylor, she is a firefighter in Rhode Island. Is that
yeah,
right?
In Providence, Rhode Island, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. How does that feel?
Again, I'm so proud of her. She did not always have it easy and struggled a bit. But when she finally came to her decision, I had helped to inspire her with some of my Navy SEAL buddies, and it really got her back on track. And I challenge any firefighter to go up against her pull-ups, push-ups, sit-ups.
Ooh.
Because she'll kick their butts.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I want to follow her on Instagram. Does she have an Instagram?
Yeah, I'm sure she does. I don't. I'm sure she does.
Right. I'll try to find her. That's great.
She is finishing up right now. She's finishing up Army Reserve training, and she's going to be an Army medic also.
Amazing.
Again, I said this about young Michael. I'll say it about Taylor. Our country's in capable hands.
Yes. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Wow. Tim Brown, thank you so much. This was an incredible journey. You have an incredible story. You are an incredible man. And I am so grateful that you exist and that you agreed to come on and share your story with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, Tim, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to The Only One in the Room. Please join us each Tuesday and Sunday for an incredible brand new Only One interview. And every Friday for On My Nightstand, where I'll be reading something that I love. If you have an Only One story you'd like to share, or a piece of writing you'd like to submit, please send it to theonlyonepod@gmail.com. From all of us at The Only One in the Room, we wish you dopeness, health, and prosperity.
Hello, dear stranger. I'd like to introduce you to something new, or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. Steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica, the Heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.